The large leafy tree seems to call to the monks, I'm here for you to shelter. Clearly, the partridges and quails got the same message. The tree's multiple branches spread out, creating canopy, protecting until rain gets too much. He, the Buddha, has just led others in meditation and a Dharma talk. Now he feels his thirst and grabs the clay jug of water to drink deeply. Today is special. Instead of going into the local village, as is their custom, to ask for food from the community, the monks prepare their own food over a cook fire. Smells of milk rice, mushrooms, and honey balls make his mouth water. Makes my mouth water. In previous years, the monks spent almost all of their time traveling the countryside, meditating, sharing teachings to whomever was interested to listen. But many of them had become aware of the need to pause their regular daily activities and focus on spiritual disciplines in community. Because of ahimsa, the principle of doing no harm to other sentient beings or to life, one sect of ascetics called the Jains had objected broadly throughout the region to any monks traveling during the monsoon season. The Jains protested that walking the lands during the monsoon season too often involved trampling down the new grass or distressing plants or hurting many little creatures. And the Buddha was convinced by that argument. He said, you are right. And then he selected a spot for the community to spend many weeks on end in concentrated activities and spiritual practices. And now, it seemed every day, more folks who had been living and working in the nearby bamboo grove were arriving over here to participate in retreat. Committing to spend an extended period of time together and engaging a schedule of spiritual disciplines had become highly valuable to the Buddha and his gathered followers. Earlier in his life, the Buddha had made many attempts to encounter the experiences which he thought to be possible. Eventually, he had found it. Goes by many names, Nibbana. It was one which includes an enveloped sense of peace and well-being. Now Buddha invites others to participate in experiences that they would appreciate only if they themselves, well, experienced it. In other words, the Buddha believed that just because he believed in nirvana, the others should not take him at his word alone. They themselves could experiment and likely experience the envelopment of peace and wholeness that he found. If they did certain activities, he felt they had a much better chance. And then he said, you can form your own beliefs and say what you believe to be true. Experience first. In some ways, a universalist himself, Buddha believed that anybody can cultivate this experience for themselves. Anybody. Everybody. We all have possibilities to experience peace and wholeness. In summer, Some people are blessed to have what the Buddha would call a retreat experience. This summer, some people had days or even weeks to feed their souls. Some had a few hours here and there to feed their souls. Summer is an ideal and an experience of slowing down. At its best, slowing down to intentionally pay attention and connect with that which is holy. Elizabeth Tarbo paid attention in her August reverie, writing, "I hear the song of crickets and the satin swish of ocean tumbled pebbles, and my heart reminds me that God is here, creating a world so wonderful, a prayer so obvious, that could I but cease in my fever of petition, I could witness its beauty too." Even when we're less open, summer can benefit us in making time and space to cultivate a relationship with wholeness and peace. When I get stuck in my loops of going over my to-do lists, at times summer just presses through on me. When rain is falling at night, almost undetectably soft, or throwing itself and playing a song against the window, if I surrender and pay attention, I can sense an envelopment of peace. If I look out during the day, raindrops splatter on the glass or fall through the air and disappear in the grass. If I pay attention, I call it making space for grace. Summer can remind us to make space for grace. Within the varieties of religious experience, I believe that when our Unitarian Universalist forebears talked about grace, they were talking about an experience similar to what the Buddha called nirvana or enlightenment. At the very least, there are important similarities, and I'm not the first to point to it. As early as the 1830s, Unitarian minister Ralph Waldo Emerson was looking east, learning from Eastern religions, finding connections and similarities with our own. Like nirvana, grace involves experiences of deeper compassion and kindness for ourselves and others. Grace involves relief, feeling light or solace. Grace involves a feeling of belonging and being in the right place. Not the only place that you can be, but the right place for right now. Another similarity is that human beings can't simply manufacture enlightenment or grace. You can't sit down and follow the directions and have it. Voila. Moments of enlightenment are not included on the benefits of your frequent flyer plan. You get 25,000 miles and just cash them in. Yes, at times we can create space and experience it, but nothing we're talking about stops the ongoing slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, which we all go through. We suffer. Nothing immunizes from pain. But it is good and right to intentionally make space to open up to those experiences of peace and well-being. It's good and right to do experiences which remind us that our inherent dignity and worth is not defined by working or what you produce materially or financially. You don't get that report and figure out how much inherent dignity and worth you have. I know a woman who was in early recovery from alcoholism. Judy, I'll call her. And Judy was struggling with tough feelings of low self-esteem, painful loneliness. And she decided to go camping with some other women in early recovery. She said, I've been camping once and I hated it. But I said, you know what? What the heck? I want to spend some time with new healthy friends, and I'll give this nature thing a try again. She brought her bike. And at one point during the weekend of camping, Judy took a bike ride by herself, which was kind of new for her anyway, on its own accord. And she said it was like nothing she'd ever experienced before. The breeze felt like heaven. She not only didn't get tired, but as she rode, she gained energy as the miles passed below her tires. She not only felt no loneliness, she felt connected to everything. She said, I thought I was tripping, but I'm sober now. She felt like singing out loud at the top of her lungs, on a bike, riding through some park and some campgrounds. And that sounds to me like a religious experience similar to what the Buddha told the monks they might find if they joined retreat. And we're leaving summer now. You may be saying, Kent, you should have preached this sermon in June. Dude, I'm going back into my busy, busy time now. This is like unfair. I hear you, if that's a thought. And I'm reminding all of us, including myself, that we can practice these approaches to life in small doses all year long. The practice of paying attention to what is, to being present to what is, creates space for grace. If you're weeding, be in your weeding. If you're chopping carrots, chop your carrots. If you get a chance to take a 30-minute walk in the Wissahickon or go sit on a bench in Ned Wolf Park, pay attention and be in the experience. What are the ways in which your spirit feels called to slow down and appreciate beauty or listen to your soul? The other thing I'm reminding all of us, including myself, is the Buddha taught, yes, you can go off, and the monks were off on their own for many months, walking and sharing, but eventually you need to be in community. We can't do it all by ourselves all the time. I have not met that person yet. We need beloved community where we are known and we know, where we help each other realize our greatest potential, including in engaging ahimsa, not hurting others whenever you can. Don't hurt others. Sometimes this means choosing to be kind rather than to be right. Choosing to be kind, that's a tough one for Kent. Sometimes, historically, listen, truth-telling is important right now. Afflicting the comfortable surely is very important in all communities of America. However, it doesn't get us off the hook that hurting somebody to no benefit unnecessarily is a losing proposition spiritually. Buddha taught it all the time. Still true. Right now, our nation is living through bleak times. Bleak. We have a toxic, treasonous president. Economically, the middle and bottom sections of our country are being left out with insufficient support in public schools and health care and the military and prison industrial complexes are on steroids. Look at the latest military spending bill the president signed within the last month and try and even understand how much money we're spending on military. I think it makes us spending, we have 70% of the world's military budget without good enough public schools in all these places, so many places. Bleak. Climate change exacerbates droughts and floods. World sea levels are rising at catastrophic rates. Look at Hawaii, let alone Kerala, right now. Look at what happened in Kerala, India, in the last 2 weeks, if you haven't. If you need it, maybe it's too heartbreaking for you. I get that. King Pasenidi visited the Buddha's village. His retreat was taken aback by the authentic, impressive kindness demonstrated by the monks. The king observed monks. He said, wow, they're not faking it. They are not simply, and they're not simply being polite to one another to follow some rules of etiquette. These monks are clearly embodying a kindness which transforms lives. And the king said, I need that kind of kindness to change my court and the halls of power. By making space for grace, paying attention, feeling life, we can increase our loving kindness for ourselves, for each other, and for the wider world. And it may seem counterintuitive, but I am saying, I believe, and I think you believe too, that the ideal and practice of summer and retreat and spiritual practices at their very best can help us save the soul of the nation. And it is sick. We've got a soul-sick nation. These things can save the soul of the nation. We can become ever-powerful disciples of love, disciples of a love beyond belief. Disciples of love, people, look it up historically, and we'll keep talking about it. Disciples of love can make tyrants tremble. It can bring them to their knees and begin new eras of justice. It can happen. Disciples of love, though, you don't just think, oh, it's a good Saturday, I'll go be a disciple of love and change the government for something I'm hoping it'll become, or to change my neighborhood to be better. No, you have to be disciplined regularly. Disciples of love pay attention to quails and raindrops and bike rides. Disciples of love smile at others with an authentic kindness which can melt hearts and build lives of hope. Blessings be. May it be so.